tonight on Arena, Ian Lynch of Lancome on his soundtrack for Paul Dwan's film All You Need Is Death, and Ferdy Lennon on his debut novel Glorious Exploits.
#51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Last November, we spoke to filmmaker Paul Dwan about All You Need Is Death. Horror and Shano singing were brought together in this film, where overzealous song collectors come a cropper when they mess with the rules of the oral tradition, leading to a body horror fest. All You Need Is Death has screened at various film festivals, and it gets its cinema release here in Ireland this Friday. The touchstone for making this film, Paul Dwan told us, was the resurgence in Irish folk music with the likes of Lisa O'Neill, John Francis Flynn and Lancome. So who better to write and compile the soundtrack for All You Need Is Death than Ian Lynch of Lancome. Delighted to say that Ian is with me in studio this evening. Are you messing with the oral tradition? Are you messing with the song collectors? It's a trade.
Maybe a little bit. And after watching this film a number of times, I think I better watch my step from here on in. But it was really fantastic to be involved in this film. And, you know, and Paul got in touch with me when he first wrote the script and passed it on to me and wanted to know what I thought about it. He later on told me that if I hadn't have said it was good to go, he would have considered not putting it out at all, which was a really amazing compliment. But just considering my interest in both horror as a genre of film and literature, and also obviously the folk tradition, I just think it was the perfect project.
So there is a past interest. We know about your interest in music, obviously via Lancome and other projects, but there is a previous interest in horror.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Since a very early age, I think I was 7 or 8 years old when my father let me stay up late to watch Salem's Lot on television. And then from there on in, I was just hooked on horror all the way through my teens, and it's still probably the genre of film that I enjoy most.
Do you think that has informed the way you particularly, I mean, everybody talks that old label doom folk, but you know, the way you approach music, has that kind of horror background in your imagination informed it?
Most likely, yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, it's probably desensitized me to a lot of like horror on the screen, horror soundtracks and things like that. So I don't get the kind of the shock value when I watch films. I don't get afraid when I watch films. That's not something I'm looking for. I'm more interested in the atmosphere that's created within horror films. That they seem to be able to just create atmospheres that don't really exist in other genres of film for me.
All right, well, let's listen to a track, one of the tracks that I think really gives us a sense of atmosphere. This is quite early on in the film. Actually, I'm going to play the Hung by Wire, where the section that's caused that. We'll have a listen to it and we'll talk about the instrumentation afterwards, because the instrumentation here is very interesting. Wire, part of the soundtrack that Ian Lynch has composed for Paul Dwan's film All You Need Is Death. And even as we listen to that, Ian, you were talking about atmosphere. That really, it's quite early in the film. We're kind of just getting to know who the various characters are. We know it's a little bit of an odd situation where we're not quite sure how odd. What instruments are involved in creating that atmosphere for us there?
So the main instrument you heard there was a small handheld harp. Sounds like a dulcimer, yeah, yeah. But a lot smaller and more basic. I found that in the States a number of years ago in a shop, made in Russia, from what I can ascertain, but it's just something I've had lying around.
Waiting to be used.
Just waiting to be used. Never got to use it in Lancome for whatever reason, but finally made its debut here on this. Yeah.
So there is that little section that's, you know, quite melodic, dum, ding, 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 and then that bdoing section, which is much more atonal. Is that the same instrument, or are you doing something with it there?
The same instrument layered with, there's like plucked fiddle strings in there too. There's a good bit of post-processing I did with most of the tracks on the album, which was involved like pitching things down by octaves or putting them through certain filters and things like that on the DAW, as they call it, or the digital audio workstation, which in this case was Logic Pro I was using. So that's just the whole another part of the process.
This sounds like Ian Lynch, film composer, is alive and well and starting out, is he?
Well, I mean, it's something I always had in my head that I wanted to do. And after Paul asked me about doing the soundtrack, I kind of just dove into the world of film soundtracks in a big way. I was reading all the books I could find, listening to podcasts, watching YouTube tutorials, and just the number of different ways that you can kind of make a cue for a scene in a film and trying to figure out, what am I going for here? Am I trying to just create a sense of atmosphere, or am I foreshadowing something that's going to happen? Am I trying to maybe tell another story about what's happening behind the scenes? Am I trying to bring out kind of the emotional core of this scene, just magnifying that a little bit? So there's so many different approaches you can take when you're scoring a scene like that, and that's just something I found really fascinating about the whole process.
Did you study how Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead does his soundtracks? Did you study how Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails does his soundtracks? He's recently the film Challenger.
Trent Reznor, yeah.
Everybody's talking about that.
But big influences for me when I was doing this one were Arrival by Johan Johansson, Under the Skin by Mika Levy, Colin Stetson, who did the soundtrack for Hereditary, like kind of big horror films, which I found like had really, like really amazing soundtracks to them.
Yeah, because while this is essentially a small independent film, but would you have a desire to go into that, you know, that much bigger production?
Yeah, I would love to, particularly because, you know, a big part of the process of making a score for this film was figuring out how it all works, you know, figuring out how to use the computer programs, figuring out exactly what I want to do, how to find a tempo for a scene, how to just get everything set up to write the actual cues. But I feel like now I kind of have a lot of that figured out. I'd love to go ahead and try it again on the new feature. Yeah, absolutely.
The story within All You Need Is Death, it's very much, as I said, about this idea of these song collectors who go getting a song from a really... she's infamous, I suppose, is what we'd say, rather than famous singer. But the rules are, you're not allowed to write the song down. You can't record it, or if you do record it, it cannot be for public consumption. Mm-hmm. Have you ever come across that kind of, you know, protection around a song?
Yeah, absolutely, I have. And I think that's why when I read the script first, it really struck a chord at me, no pun intended. It's definitely something... Yeah, just the transgression of that kind of rule, you know, and a lot of times it's an unspoken rule, but I've definitely have come across that people expressing just great anger that they found out later that somebody had been secretly recording a singing session or a song that they'd sang and it had ended up on the internet somewhere. That's something I've definitely heard people talk about a lot over the years.
And I'm guessing that's not about, oh, they took my performance and they made money out of it. It's about they're actually... breaking the rules here. They're actually really breaking confidence. This was supposed to be a private performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think no one, if you're in a singing session, for example, and you're opening yourself up, you're vulnerable in a kind of very big way to know that maybe somebody is there recording who's going to then send around that recording to other people. You know, that could really just shake your confidence to do that. And I think that's why I liked about this film, that's the main transgression in the film that's made, and there's big, big consequences. Yeah,
now, this isn't realism in terms of what happens to people who disseminate.
Not that we know of, anyway.
We hope not. because what happens is, as I said, it's a gore fest, it's a blood fest, what happens later on in the film. But Alwyn Fuere's character, she is the singer, this vessel of this ancient song.
Yeah, Rita Concannon.
Yeah, give us the setup of who Rita Concannon is and the song that she has within her.
Yeah, so Rita Concannon, she would have been one of a long line of female singers, and the idea is that this song has been passed
fictional,
down.
Fictional.
No need, needless to say. Passed down from mother to daughter. Originally in the film, the song collectors are looking for her mother, I believe, and they find out that she's passed away, but then they're told, oh no, she has a daughter that's still alive. They go and visit her, and at first she's very reticent about, you know, singing this song in front of them, but eventually she takes a shine to Anna, one of the song collectors, and sings it for her. But the idea is that this song is so old and so ancient, it's actually in early Irish language rather than modern Irish, and Rita herself can't even understand the words. She just knows that this is a song with great power. It's not to be sung in front of men, it's not to be written down, like you said, not to be recorded. She just faithfully, she has this song. It's not something she sings that often, I presume. She just knows the song. She passed the song, it's fine now. It's recorded surreptitiously, and all hell breaks loose. Something is opened in the world. A portal is opened, and a great evil escapes.
Let's listen to Alwyn Ferry. And what I think here is it's a type of old Irish that she's using, isn't it, within the song itself. This is from the soundtrack to the film All You Need Is Death.
The bed, Henry, in yon cave of Noy, the Ratna.
Voice of Alwyn Ferry there from the film All You Need Is Death, composer of the soundtrack for that film, Ian Lynch, with me in studio this evening. That is a Lancome track in the making, I would argue. Ian, talk to me a little bit about the making of that song, because in the film, what happens before she starts to sing that, Alwyn Ferry takes these, as the character Rita Concannon, takes these two breaths in, a few breaths, and they're really frightening. And then this song pours out of her. How involved was she in the making of the song with you?
Well, that particular song, it's really the centrepiece of the whole film, you know. And that's something that we've been working on. Like, it was one of the first things we worked on. So how it came about was Paul wrote the words to the song in English as if they were a bad translation from an old Irish song. And then I took those English words, translated them into early Irish, which is, for those of you who don't know, the version of Irish that was spoken from around between the 7th and 10th centuries AD. It's quite a different language in a lot of different ways. There's
and
difference.
You have that? You had studied that in some way?
I've got a degree in early Irish, yeah, from UCD. I mean, it's a long time since I did the degree, but I felt like I had enough to give it a stab anyway. And then the idea was I would make this rough translation and then maybe show it to somebody who was an actual like scholar of early Irish practicing to kind of, you know, fix it up or see where it needed corrections. Mother of my friends, Hildred Creel, she's another early Irish scholar and an amazing poet in her own right. She helped really so much with the translation. She had, you know, for each line, she'd be like, oh, well, this phrase is attested to in this manuscript, but in this manuscript it appears in this way with different, you know, there's a subtle change in meaning here, so maybe we'll go with this meaning. And she was so good at the translation.
You brought a lot to it. But were you actually on set
Yeah, so I was on set. Sorry, the point I was getting to. So we made the early Irish translation, then I put the air to it. Mm. Then I made a recording of myself singing the song to the air, sent that to Alwyn along with the lyrics and a phonetic rendering of the early Irish. Then Alwyn learned it from that and then on the set sang the ballad as we heard it there. And I was actually on set hiding behind a couch with Paul Dwan as we were filming it, and the place we were in looked exactly as the way it did on screen. Like, I looked down at one moment and it was like a little maggot crawling along the floor.
Yeah, because it is a pretty creepy house that she's in.
It was amazing to use as a set for a film, but I mean, Alwyn, just that's the performance she gave on the day on set.
So what we get on the soundtrack was the performance on set, and it's stripped.
Yeah, and it was absolutely unreal. I think all of us in the room were just like, what the hell?
And then as it goes on there, obviously it starts just with her voice and all the instruments that creep in underneath it. I'm wondering about, you're talking about that degree in early Irish. Did you use musical knowledge or knowledge of music from that period and instrumentation from that period in any way when it came to making the soundtrack?
No, not really. I mean, I kind of had the idea in my head for the soundtrack in general. My approach was, I wanted it to sound like primal and brutal. And in my head, I kind of imagined if the instruments we have today, like the accordions and the eelin pipes and fiddles, if people back then got their hands on these instruments and they had to compose music to some rituals or something, what would they come up with? Just something really just primal sounding, that's kind of my guiding light for the soundtrack in general.
But that is the song I sung by Alwyn Ferrer. But to prove, this whole idea of how different a song can be when somebody else sings it, the character of Anna is one of those song collectors who goes along to get the song from the Alwyn Ferrer character. And later in the film, we hear her singing the song. Very different type of sound, this one. This is and it's now called A New Dawn, but it's an old song.
Oh, Bertrandry, Enyan Coifdamnoi, Doranae, Reaia, Avulshi, and Eski.
That's Simone Collins, the actor there in the part of Anna, singing the song, which is called A New Dawn, an old song from the film All You Need Is Death. Ian Lynch, composer, with me in studio. Now, we heard that in the Alwyn Ferrer version a bit earlier, Ian, and then that version there, it's still got a creepy kind of eerie quality to it, but it's amazing how a different character, a different situation makes the song very different. I presume that filmic end of things is very different, or is it, from singing in a session, doing a regular performance of a song with a band?
Yeah, I think so, but I think it really kind of brings a sense of how the tradition works, when a younger singer learns a song from an older singer and the different changes that can come through. That's something that I hear all the time. As far as I know, Simone Collins learned the song kind of phonetically from Alwyn singing it in the film as well. So you can kind of hear that, the different pronunciations of words and stuff.
Isn't that brilliant, though, that she actually learned it, orally, literally, by listening to Alwyn's version, and then she comes up with her version?
It's fantastic. I loved hearing it.
And that, I suppose that speaks to what you and Lancome are doing all the time, listening to those older versions of songs from whatever older singers and players and making it your own.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's just another reason why I was drawn to this film, why it made so much sense to me.
When is film project number two starting?
No idea. Paul has a few ideas up his sleeve, so waiting to hear. If Paul wants to go for it again, I'd be happy to score another one of his films.
And outside of horror, or is horror really where you'd like to
flex
the muscles?
It would be definitely a challenge if somebody asked me to score a rom-com. That would be it'd be a lot more difficult for me to do, but I'd definitely give it a shot, Might not turn out to be romantic or funny, but
say yes and worry about how you do it afterwards.
Exactly.
We'll finish up with a track called Marshall
Krapkusuk, which I think is your own word here, is it really? Is it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I've checked it with a few other like scholars of modern Irish, and they reckon it's good.
You'll take
Irish
it.
Grammar. Yeah, yeah. The Crippled March. And with this one, I think it kind of speaks to what we do at Lancome, like you were talking about there, taking old songs, taking old tunes and kind of doing our own thing with it. Because this one, if you remember in the film, is after somebody sings a version of Wheelie Wheelie Wile Ya. And so basically what I took the tune and kind of tried to make a twisted version of the same melody.
And there's a reedy instrument in the middle of all of this. Do you remember what that was, or is that an effect added after the event?
In this one, what I remember is I was playing a viola and I recorded that onto a reel-to-reel tape recorder, played it back at half speed, and then over the top of that I'm playing a hurdy-gurdy. And there's also with an old, there's a big shamanic hand drum that I'm banging as well. And then there's a couple of other noisy bits thrown in for good measure. But it was mainly the viola and the hurdy-gurdy.
And
that
given that we're in a horror world, hardly surprising then that things have been done backwards, played backwards.
Oh yeah, there's a good bit of that on this score. Yeah, it's something I love the sound of.
Ian, lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks so much for coming in to us. And this is from the soundtrack to All You Need Is Death. Not a Beatles song to be heard anywhere within it. It has to be said. This is Marshall Krapkusuk. Have it, Marshall Krapkusuk from the soundtrack to All You Need Is Death. Ian Lynch of Lancome's talking to us about his compositions there. All You Need Is Death, the film, will be in cinemas from this Friday. The soundtrack is available digitally now and will be available on vinyl on May the 10th. And we will be reviewing the film itself, All You Need Is Death, on Thursday night's Arena. Galway's in annual International Festival of Literature, Coorch, begins on Tuesday week, April the 23rd, and over the next couple of weeks, we will be featuring some of the literary stars that will be taking part. On Thursday week, in the debut novelist slot, writer Ferdy Lennon will be sharing his story of Athenian prisoners, spoils of the ancient Peloponnesian Wars between Athens and Sparta, who are left to starve in the quarries of Syracuse until they share their knowledge of Euripides with two theatre nuts. I'm delighted to be joined by Ferdy Lennon in studio this evening. And until I get to the phrase theatre nuts in the midst of that, it sounds, oh, right, this is a very worthy classical story being retold by this young writer. You're kind of throwing this story up in the air and letting it fall down in a very Dublinese fashion, I would argue. Yeah. And part of the way you do that is with your two characters, Lampo and Gellin. Lampo in particular, she even sounds like he's a dub.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks very much, Sean, for noticing that. Yeah, I chose to, I think in a way, when we think of classical Greece and classical stories, we often have these kind of either mythic heroes, mythic gods, or like famous figures, Socrates, Pericles. And I just wanted to go at it from left field. And instead of that, have these two unemployed potters who speak almost like, contemporary dubs. Mm. And part of that as well is Sicily was an island. It had been colonized by mainland Greece. So I was looking for a parallel. So I thought it would make more sense than just having kind of the traditional RP British English if we had a kind of different approach.
Yeah, and just to give that historical background and setting to it, I suppose, we're in the Peloponnesian Wars. What are we talking about when we talk about the Peloponnesian Wars?
Yeah, so it was a war that began between Athens and Sparta. There was basically fear of Athens' imperialistic ambitions. They just kept spreading and spreading. And it eventually went over to Sicily, where Athens, they said there was a humanitarian intervention, but really they wanted to conquer the island. And it was one of the great kind of military disasters in history. They had this attitude. They didn't call it Christmas, but we'll be home by Christmas.
Yeah.
A few years later, there are thousands of prisoners in these quarries that you can see today. And we know from the historical record that some of these prisoners survived because the Syracusan captors were so obsessed with Athenian drama and poetry that they would give them extra food and rations for in exchange for quotes.
Yeah, and that particular aspect, I think you came across a little snippet, literally. Was it in Plutarch?
Exactly. Plutarch's Life of Nicias, he mentions this little snippet. And then suddenly for me, this very epic story became kind of human and personal.
And the snippet is there were prisoners in quarries and they were given food for quotes.
Exactly. That Euripides was like the blockbusters of ancient Greece, you know, popular entertainment.
Mm.
The cultural connection is severed during the war between Athens and Sicily because they're at war. So they don't have any of the greatest hits. So these theatre-obsessed potters go down imagining maybe these people will have lines from Euripides, and they did.
So it literally was. It was like sing me a song, but it was do Euripides' poem for me there, and I'll give you a bit of this bread and cheese.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or as Lampo puts it, that smelly cheese Ma makes. he refers to his mother as Ma.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's part of that. That's part of that vernacular, and that parallel. I suppose one of the reasons for putting it into that Dublin vernacular then. There's a touch of the Hiberno English and that kind of our post-colonial and our colonial experiences in there too.
Completely. You try to find with historical fiction, I suppose for me, parallels and different resonances. And Athens was the great imperial power, the great maritime power that was spreading its influence. So I just thought that would be a different way of doing it, but it would make sense.
Now, you studied the classics. That was part of your primary degree. But the interest in these stories goes back a long, long way.
Yeah, it does. It really does for me. I think even as a kid, I remember getting a book of, I think I won it in school, about Greek, the Greek gods and the Greek myths, and I would learn them off. So I've always been fascinated with these stories. And then also studying them later on, how relatable, oddly, like the politics, there are a lot more parallels than you might imagine.
Yeah, but I'm interested in that idea that when you got those books as a child, you know, because the language can be quite high flown, even if they've been simplified in some way for younger readers, the language can be quite high flown. Were you already reading them in a kind of in your own voice or in voices that you were hearing on the streets around you?
Yeah, I think maybe not at that. I suppose in one way, you always sometimes imagine these characters. You see yourself, if you don't see yourself in them, you make them relatable in some way. The turning point was almost reading Aristophanes plays because they're the comedies. We think of like the great tragedies, but you actually have the only works set in contemporary Athens were Aristophanes' plays. And if you pick them up now, it's almost like Monty Python. They're like surreal. They're very funny. But oddly, there is none of that highfalutin language. They're quite sweary. They're slang. And I kind of realised there was a disconnect between the way contemporary novelists would often write about ancient Greece and the way that a Greek person living in Athens did it.
And yeah, because it's important to remember that the position of Greek theatre at that time, in as much as you can get documentary evidence on this, but this was like going to the cinema. They didn't go home and watch the telly, obviously.
So no Netflix.
It was that type of entertainment. It was for everybody. It wasn't just for the higher ups in society with the great minds who went out and basically ate their artistic broccoli every night by going to a Greek tragedy.
That's exactly it. It's like Shakespeare, popular entertainment. They needed to, this was what people kind of lived for.
Tell me a little bit more about Lampo and Gelin then, because while Lampo is, as his name suggests, I mean, the minute I read his name, I had a kind of almost painted this character, kind of wide boy. He has his eye on a local slave girl, and you know he's hoping for a bit of love there as well. But Gelin is a different kettle of fish altogether.
Yeah, absolutely. So Gelin is the one who is, you know, has the deep love of theatre. He's someone who's had experienced real personal tragedy. He's lost his son, his wife has left him. He's dealing with some very difficult things. And almost his solace has become this art of Athens, these tragedies of Euripides, Whereas Lampo, Gallon loves theatre, Lampo loves Gallon. He's kind of along for the ride.
Yeah, Lampo loves the crack.
He loves the crack as well.
he's up for a bit of fun. The decision comes then that they might put on a production of Medea in these quarries with the prisoners as actors. Is that aspect of the novel a totally imagined aspect?
That's my jumping off point. That's the kind of the creative leap. Now, interestingly, because of the way those plays were produced, you would have had almost certainly some of those prisoners would have acted in the original productions. So it is plausible that you would actually have these actors in chains who would know the lines and, you know, could give a performance. But yeah.
And I guess there was no telly or no cinema for them to go to. Were these plays written down in any way, or were they purely passed on it through the oral tradition?
It was kind of a mix of both. So eventually they were written down, and that's why we have them. And interestingly enough, you have cases where some of Euripides' most popular play is lost. Telephus was his biggest play at the time, but we don't have it because it was written down, but we lost the copies. So they were written down, but...
And the fact that you chose to have Lampo and Gellin, you know, that Euripides was the big star of the day, does that reflect in some ways your own particular favourite within the Greek canon?
Somewhat. I love them all, to be honest. I think it reflects just the historical thing that in Sicily they were obsessed with Euripides. He was a guy who was very innovative. So the critics in Athens felt he was ruining the theatre.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But people loved him, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I suppose the other aspect that's important here, I mean, Athens, we're coming in to help and we're coming in to improve everything.
Yeah, that's it.
It's one of the great colonisers' lines, you know, we'll sort out all your problems and we'll exploit everything. We can get as much money and capital out of you as we possibly can. But there's a discussion, particularly in and around Gellin and his attitude, again, given that he's more the aesthete and the real lover of theatre, this idea that art can and it has the possibility to be such a unifying force. You don't have to love your enemy, but you can love your enemy's poetry.
That's it. It's that interesting aspect. It was that contradiction that drew me to it, the idea that they would dehumanise these prisoners to the point that they would leave them to starve, and yet recognise something in their poetry and their art that would make them want to save them. That combination of empathy and cruelty that I was interested in. Yeah.
The other thing, I suppose, within Greek tragedy is, you know, we don't see things necessarily on stage, but we get some fairly gory exploits spelled out to us. How have you handled that within the novel?
Yeah, that's a good point, because they're often the Greek tragedies were very violent. Mm. They wouldn't show it on, you know.
Yeah, they told they didn't show. Yeah.
Yeah, the chorus would come on. Oh, he's getting his head chopped off. But I don't want to give any spoilers. But that's certainly in the production. It's something that has to be navigated.
Yeah, so you're not going to tell us, but that was something that you clearly had to get your head around how that would actually be done.
How would they dramatize it? Yeah, how would they,
drawing parallels? Then there is this, you know, I suppose, desire, and people do it all the time, that you look at the Greek tragedies and you make direct parallels to situations happening on our television screens today. Mm. Are you wary of that? Do you agree with that kind of idea of drawing those parallels and maybe learning lessons from the mistakes of the past?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. Like, for example, one of the plays that they end up producing is this play called Trojan Women, which is essentially what happens to the women of Troy after it's destroyed by Greece. And Euripides almost certainly wrote that in response to an Athenian invasion of this smaller island and what Athens did to the population. So even back then, you have a situation where writers were using these myths to make contemporary points. So I think it's inevitable, and it's part of what allows these stories to continue, is the fact that we can find these meanings. Okay. Initially I wasn't trying to write this story to have a contemporary point. But as Euripides says in his, you know, History of the Peloponnesian War. In his introduction, he says, human nature being what it is, these events will happen again, but in a different form. So I think that's...
And you mentioned the Trojan women with the Cassandras. Is she within that particular strand of the story? Because that's who... it's Lampo refers to as a wreck the head. Cassandra's a bit of a wreck the head.
Yeah.
There is that fine line that I guess you have to navigate in the way you've told the novel, which is reverence in some ways to the stories that you're retelling, but allowing the little bit of crack and fun to come in. How difficult was that to strike? How quickly did that balance come, or was there a lot of to-ing and fro-ing?
Yeah, I think it's in the character. That's the way. If this story was narrated by Gellon, who has this deep reverence,
it'd be very different.
It'd be very different. It's all about the lens and who's seeing things. And I like the idea of Lampo is almost in a tragedy, but he sees it as a comedy until it isn't, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. The other aspect, I suppose, of the linguistic aspect, you know, we've talked about that Hiberno-English thing. Mm. What about Irish myths and Irish mythology? Do you see parallels? Would you attempt, or would you like to tackle one of those great myths, which again are often given in quite high flown, kind of mythical type of language? Would you like to have a go at one of those?
Like to have a stab
and pull it down to whatever particular vernacular you wanted?
Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, I love Irish mythology. There's even a figure in this.
Yes.
The kind of mysterious merchant Turin, which for me, that was a playful reference to the myth of the sons of Turin, where about the, you know, these brothers have to go around and they go to Greece and they go to Sicily, etc. So, yeah, I would like to. I don't know if I'd do it in the same way, but the Irish mythology is, they were one of the stories that I kind of grew up with. Some amongst them.
You know. I was saying to you, I was checking with you when you came in this evening, said, have we actually met before? And you reminded me about it as an item you did a few years back at this.
Good stage. While ago now.
Yeah, it was your first story ever published, and you were in talking about that. It was in a collection at the time. And here we have now the debut novel. The debut novel is out and published. So what is the state of play in the writing life of Ferdie Lennon at this point in time?
Yeah, so I'm kind of working away. I mean, the book is out now, which is great, and now I'm working on the next one. That's always the, which is also a work of historical fiction, but a very different period. So I've moved away from ancient Greece, but
Can you tell me more about the where and the when of the next one?
Yeah, I mean it's set in medieval, it's set in medieval France. This one, during the kind of Hundred Years' War, so it's. Also a very chaotic, quite fascinating period of history, you know, in the midst of, you've a lot of different things happening in France during that period.
Yeah, so the historical side of things is part of it for you. That leap that you've made with the current novel, pulling it from the past right up into the present.
Yeah.
Are you doing something similar here? And how difficult is it to do that? You know, you can't just yank it and make it a modern give it a modern feel. How difficult a process is it to get that?
Yeah, I think
temporary resonance.
That's it. It's how difficult is it? I think this one is gonna. The next one is gonna be different. It's not gonna be how are you doing, Jean-Pierre? You know, you know, it's not gonna be dubs in you know medieval Paris. So it's going to be stylistically quite different. You know, I'm sure you'll find parallels because the same kind of some of the same concerns will be in there. But I think you always, it's in that strange, the balance of historical fiction is making it grounded in the period and the detail. But of course, it needs to have a contemporary relevance, you know.
I do like the sound of the How You Doing, Jean-Pierre novel. That one comes. Maybe that's your third or fourth novel.
Yeah, yeah. I'll get that ready for you next time.
Well, listen, thanks so much for coming into us this evening, Ferdie. That's Ferdie Lennon. And Glorious Exploits is Ferdie's debut novel. Ferdie will be at Kirch in Galway on Friday week, is it? Yes, Friday week, March the 26th, with fellow debut novelist Colin Walsh for his novel Cala. Is that how we say it?
Yeah.
Cala, beg your pardon. And that event will be taking place in Taivyark na Gáileava. Full information on kurch.ie. Now, previously on Arena, we've been joined by art historian Jess Fahey. Every year, she travels to different countries to explore the art collections around the world. She doesn't go alone, however. She brings groups of people on these tours with her to the cities, and she shares her passion and knowledge of the arts. Destinations have included Amsterdam, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Malaga, and most recently, Madrid. Your next trip, Jess Fahey, is to Berlin, a city with an equally rich art history, and you are with me in studio now to talk us through some of the highlights. So you're just back from Madrid, yeah, and heading off to Berlin in 2 weeks' time. Two very different cities. Do you start to think of those cities purely in terms of artistic, not merit, but I suppose whatever artistic flavours they have to offer?
Absolutely. That's one of my favourite things to do about it, is because you don't just get absorbed in the art, but that will tell you the history and the culture of the place you're in. And between Berlin and Madrid, there's massive differences, particularly culturally, and the kind of interest that artists would have followed over the years reflect that as well.
So you're coming from the hot, wild colours of Madrid to, how are you describing Berlin?
Well, it's a sort of, I suppose the difference is in terms, particularly in terms of religion. So the type of religious work you'd have in Spain traditionally would be very Baroque, very dramatic. And their painting then tends to sort of follow those styles. Whereas in Germany, if you're kind of looking at trends over time, there's much more of that northern control, tightness of handling of paint, interest in detail. So less about the kind of big and splashy and more about the kind of focused.
And I guess in the broadest of terms, that's a reflection of one of the great divisions in art, I suppose, which is between Catholic art, for want of a better adjective, and Protestant art. You know, the Reformation and the changes that that brought in terms of expression.
Absolutely. And it changes over time as well. So as you get into the 19th century and you start to look at, you know, different art movements, then depending on the religion of the country, it will have a massive effect and difference on what type of things people want to look at and see. But also the art markets are different depending on whether there's a church that is commissioning work or whether it's just the middle class, which is typical in Protestant countries.
And I guess culturally, the religion of the country starts to seep into the aesthetic preferences of every individual.
Because the ethos is sort of reflected in it. So, for example, you know, Protestant portraits, they tend to just wear black and white. It's much more controlled, reserved. Whereas some of the, you know, Catholic examples, particularly if you're thinking of Italy, would be much more about beautiful, ornate, you know, brocade and going for as flashy as possible.
All right. One of your first Berlin highlights in terms of location will be the Gemäldegalerie Art Museum. Impressive collection of works from the old masters, but unlike other European collections, it's not formed from a royal collection. Who had the money to get it for us?
So it was the Prussian government. So it's an interesting thing when you think about it, because from the time of the Louvre, which is, of course, French, which is a French Revolution era, there starts to become this awareness that one of the things that you should do for your country is to provide culture. And that particularly as you go into the 19th century, and it becomes almost like a civic duty to not just provide it, but also to know about it. So the public should go as well. So the government start collecting paintings, and particularly with this idea of them being for the public. And because of that, it means that rather than it being one person or one family or one royal collection's interests over time, which a lot of the time is just paintings of themselves, in this instance, it's deliberately sort of tracing the history of art. So the galleries that you have, in the Gemäldegalerie in particular, you can go in to one side and trace the history of Southern European art, and the other will trace the history of Northern European art. It works by each of the best painters from those eras. So it's extraordinary.
So the government's, when in that particular case, it's more about giving a broad representation and an equal representation to different forms, different expressions.
Absolutely. And it's very Enlightenment inspired, you know, that sort of categorization and cataloguing, and that we should know everything.
Let's have a look at a specific portrait then. You've a couple for us, paintings for us to look at RTE Arena, if you want to follow this on X or on Twitter, as some of us still call it. Let us have a look at this. This is a portrait of a woman with a winged bonnet. And it's very important that we say winged bonnet here. Mm-hmm. Who is the artist?
So we're looking at Roger van der Weyden, who was given the very impressive title of main painter, or town painter of Brussels. And he was the first person to have it, and it was supposed to only exist for him. He was considered such an extraordinary artist. So ultimately, in this kind of realm, we're looking at very early but still extraordinarily skilled versions of oil painting. So oil painting, really, we're really looking around the 1420s onwards, where it starts to become the predominant material used. And this creates an extraordinary thing in the art market, because it goes from the most expensive art objects being entirely based on the material. So in other words, if there's gold in it, or if it's made of silver, it has jewels, it's expensive. And painting wasn't expensive because it was cheaper materials. To this era from Roger van der Weyden and the few before him, that all of a sudden the skill of the artist equals the value of the work.
So we're in the 15th century here. He was 1400 to 1460, so the first half of the 15th century,
yes.
Essentially. Describe the painting then, or this portrait to me. A woman, a youngish woman, looking out at us, not quite directly at us, but kind of sideways at us. And it is the winged bonnet is the thing that you notice most here.
So the bonnet's called a hennin. And that comes from the word rooster, which I think is kind of funny that it's something based on a rooster's.
You can see that, actually. Yeah.
And ultimately, it would tell you a little bit about the status and the class of the person, but also for us, it helps us date things, because they went through different fashions of what they would look like. A lot of it's to do with modesty and elements like that, but that's kind of counteracted because she is almost looking at us, as you say. And there was a tradition, not just in painting, but in life, for women not to make eye contact. So one of the things that the church fathers believed was that women cause men to sin by looking at them. So women should keep their eyes downcast if they were good Christian women. And she is holding her hands as if in prayer, perhaps. But her directness, or the feeling of her looking almost at us, means that even now, if you stand in front of that painting, you feel this connection with her that you wouldn't otherwise if you were almost more voyeur-esque, if she was looking down.
Yeah, there is this sense, and maybe this is my interpretation of it, but there is a sense of this young woman who's kind of been told to put on the headgear, who's been told to wear the quite sober coloured dress for this portrait, but you have a sense that she wants to break free and out of that.
Very possibly. I like that you're calling her young, because she's usually described as matronly, given the era that we're in. So she would be probably
matronly. She has very young skin. Maybe
20s.
That's just very, very nice painting.
I think the life expectancy was a bit shorter then. But it's to highlight who she is class-wise. So the clothing would signal her as middle class, which is why there's been a suggestion that she might actually be the artist's wife, a woman called Elizabeth Gofert, who was the daughter of a shoemaker. So that would fit in with how she's
all
being
that,
presented.
Yeah, and all of that class aspect that
so
you're speaking
important.
Speaking about there. Let us look at a second image. Petrus Christus is the painter here. Again, it's a portrait of a woman in a bonnet, not a winged bonnet this time.
Different bonnet.
Different bonnet altogether. Who are we talking about with Christus, Petrus Christus?
So in his case, it's Bruges that he's predominantly working for, and mostly working for the Burgundian court. Actually, Roger van der Weyden worked for them too. But both of them were not just controlled by court commissions. They had a broader career, which again is unusual in the time. In the case of her, the woman in the portrait, she's much more wealthy, much more important. The bonnet is specific to the Burgundian court at this time. And there's been some suggestions with some of the details in her clothing and things like that. She might, in fact, be an English woman.
And again, notable in comparison to our previous lady, a little bit more flesh on display here, and jewellery on display as well.
And ermine fur. And there were sumptuary laws at the time which said what type of clothing, colours, furs, jewellery you could wear based on your position in the class system. So we know she's someone a little bit fancier, a little bit more important.
And the Gemälde Gallery, obviously hugely important in terms of Berlin, but there are other. There's more than one. UNESCO World Heritage Site, that is Berlin's Museum Island. This is five large museums involved, yeah?
Yeah, it would take almost a week to get through them all. It's really quite an extraordinary collection. Again, mostly founded in the 19th century, combination of Prussian government and influence from the Prussian kings and royalty as well. Each one focuses now on different types of collections, whereas previously it was a little more mixed. So you have one that's just classical art that deals mostly with Roman, Greek, those kind of periods. There's another then for Egyptian art, which you'll find the head of Nefertiti, so one of the most famous pieces found. Still controversial because that was actually smuggled out and probably should never have left Egypt. But those things are always going to be part of museum collecting. The Bode is purely sculpture. And that one, I think they're going to change and start adding in more of the paintings from the Gemälde Gallery, so that's not separated out so much. So there's, and then there's the 19th century German one as well, which is just German art over a 100-year period that is more mixed between painting and other objects.
There's a temporary exhibition in the Alte National Gallery, which is the old National Gallery, I think, is what we're talking about here. And this is a Caspar David Friedrich exhibition called Infinite Landscapes, 250th anniversary of his birth, in fact. I'll tweet that one of the image, an image from that right now at RTE Arena. Easy to work out why it's called Infinite Landscapes. Yeah. Maybe just describe the image first of all.
So it's a very sparse seascape where there's essentially very heavy clouded sky, very dark sea, and then sandy foreground with one tiny single figure who we know that because the artist wrote about it, that he's a monk. And on first glance, when you look at it, you take it at face value and think maybe it's a monk going for a walk by the sea. But we know with the artist Friedrich that he was more interested in the symbolism of nature, particularly through a romantic lens. And for him, that was very spiritual, in his case, Protestant. So rather than having paintings of the lives of saints, he would rather see God in nature. And in a way, he reinvents landscape as a genre of painting through this symbolic use of landscape as a reflection of God.
Yeah, and again, there's a sense of contemplation within even just this tiny figure, the monk standing in the midst of this vast landscape.
Yeah.
There's a sense of the kind of the awe and wonder of what he's looking at.
The sublime.
Around him. The East Side Gallery then, 300 metres from the Berlin Wall, turned into a very unique open-air gallery when the wall came down on the 9th of November 1989. You'll be visiting there?
Yes. So it's actually in total a kilometre. They've just been restoring it sort of 300 metres at a time. So ultimately, this was opened in 1990, where they had 118 artists from various countries around the world paint a different section as a way, I suppose, of having a commemoration of the wall that also brings a sense of unity and togetherness and opening up to the world. So it was very significant at the time. It wasn't necessarily intended to be, you know, something that stayed there forever. But as I say, they've recently restored pieces. So it's an incredible thing to go and visit and to walk along. And you can sort of walk closely and examine closely. You can walk from the other side of the road. And it just gives you a real sense of that moment in time, as you know, in terms of street art becoming a thing, but also that moment for Germany.
And just on that, you know, we've been talking mostly about historical pieces here. How vibrant a place are we talking about when we talk about contemporary art in Berlin?
Extraordinary. I mean, it seems to be where a lot of artists go. I mean, even Irish artists. I mean, there's this call there that seems like it's one of those places that if you're interested in the cutting edge and what exactly is happening now, it's absolutely the place to go. So I think the art community there is great, and they're really good at supporting artists. So there's plenty of contemporary exhibitions, some of the weirdest stuff you'll ever see, to be perfectly honest.
And
but
you just kind of bump into that in smaller galleries, I guess, as you're travelling around.
Yeah, and government funded ones as well. So I mean, it is very well looked after. They care about the art production in the city as well. But then of course you will see, you know, the legitimate street art, and then of course the illegal stuff as well. Yeah, no.
Hard our life now doing all of
Isn't
that.
Isn't it terrible?
Yes, yeah, I suppose somebody has to do it. Yeah. When are you off to Berlin? When does that happen?
So the middle of May.
Of May. Well, if you happen to be planning that type of artistic trip and would like a guide, Jess Fahey is the person to check out on her tours. You can visit her own website, which will give you full details. Jessica Fahey, art historian all one word and all lowercase.com. And that is our lot for this evening's arena. Niall Fitzmaurice and Liam Murphy researched. Stephen Higgins was the broadcast coordinator. Tom Norton was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. Fifth No Brain On. We'll be with you after the news.